While analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
It's extended into last weekend as North Korea launched more missiles. Pyongyang argues U.S.-led military exercises revived this year are a rehearsal for invasion. Amid reports North Korea may conduct a seventh nuclear test, U.S. officials warned Pyongyang the use of nuclear weapons would end its regime. In South Korea Thursday night, university peace activists gathered for a vigil outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to the U.S.-South Korea-Japan alliance and removal of President Yoon. The U.S. has also conducted renewed joint drills with Japan, including a naval fleet review as Tokyo seeks to normalize its military activities.
North Korea faces much stronger conventional forces in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which is at least partly why it showcases its missile and nuclear deterrence. With the U.S., South Korea, and Japan all bolstering their weapons and military drills, the questions are if and when North Korea will conduct a seventh nuclear test. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Another nationwide election in the United States, and it will be another drawn-out, bitterly fought, and highly divisive process to determine the final outcome for Congress. Starting with the certainties, the last-minute predictions of a Republican red wave did not materialize. They did, however, take control of at least the House of Representatives, but likely with a much smaller majority than many expected. That means America will have a divided federal government, that President Joe Biden's policymaking will be hobbled for his final 2 years, and that the Democratic Party did suffer a significant national-level defeat.
Hasn't anyone had an education? I'm appalled. We had to take the constitutional test. It is so mean-spirited. Our kids are suffering. I have a 24-year-old. They do not like this country. They do not like what's going on. And their lives are hard. This is the American dream. Now they want to take away Medicare.
In a repeat of 2020, the Senate will likely come down to a runoff vote in the state of Georgia to be held on December 6th. That means Americans will have to endure nearly a month of uncertainty.
It's stupid that we would have that, need to take that much time, but part of it's because of a structure of how our, you know, we used to have this done really, you know, just 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We had it done in 2 days, at worst case scenario, you know. But in the last three national elections, it's suddenly become an issue of, you know, we've got all this, you know, false voting, fake voting, blah, blah, blah.
Near universal worries about politically related violence didn't happen on election day, but it increasingly seems to be more accurate to call it election month.
Adding to the growing tension is that controversial ex-president Donald Trump is expected to announce on November 15th that he's running for the presidency again. America may soon be arguing over the 2024 election before the 2022 election has been completely decided.
To the chagrin of Democrats and many Republicans, at least 74% of over 250 Trump-backed candidates were victorious, and so-called 2020 election deniers won repeatedly at top state and federal levels. It appears that the factional split within the Republican Party is more cemented than ever, but the unexpected closeness of the congressional vote reveals that the overall split between America's left and right is more narrow, contested, and sharper than ever. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others, Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph Stump, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts. Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aids if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses, and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs 3 different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan blocked the key avenues and roads leading towards country's capital Islamabad, causing massive traffic jams, halting logistics, and forcing schools and offices to close. Khan, who is demanding immediate elections, survived the assassination attempt last Thursday in the eastern Punjab province, leaving him wounded along with his several party workers. Police have arrested the suspected shooter and registered a case against him. However, Imran Khan and his supporters are not satisfied with it, demanding that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a senior military official be investigated through a UN inquiry for their alleged involvement in the attack.
There's only one national leader whose name is Imran Khan. Everybody is behind him. We want free and fair investigation under United Nations investigation board.
The masses on the streets were urged due to the violent protest and road closures, asking authorities to end what they call the ongoing drama.
We are sick of such protest and unrest. Our lives and properties are not safe. Political parties should resolve their issues in the parliament instead of disturbing our lives on the streets.
While apologizing the masses over the current political uncertainty in the country, the government asked the PTI-led provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces to play their role in opening the roads to ease the life of the masses.
I apologize to the people affected by Imran Khan's long march and protests on behalf of the federal government. We strongly requested the provincial governments to open the national highways immediately.
Khan's party has announced that its anti-government march will be resumed on Thursday at the place where Khan was attacked.
The recent attack on former Pakistani Prime Minister has deepened the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
England and Wales football associations are pushing ahead with plans to peddle political messages at this year's World Cup football tournament hosted by Qatar. In a joint statement with eight other European federations, England and Wales insisted they will continue to press off-field issues in spite of a FIFA plea to focus on football.
National teams and their players choosing this sporting event to push their Western worldview so blatantly onto the Arab world is unprecedented, creating a culture war at an event which is supposed to remain free from politics.
Doha has come under fire for its human rights record, including poor treatment of migrant workers who built the competition's infrastructure. But the criticism also goes further, with activists attacking Qataris over their religious and cultural beliefs too, such as bans on alcohol, premarital relations, and Western LGBTQ culture. However, onlookers from the Muslim world have been less impressed by the anti-Qatar bandwagon.
We obviously know that they're very hypocritical, and for example, on the Ukraine issue, basically politics is coming to sport, you know, when the West feels like it. But the West cannot have it its own way all the time. And this is a World Cup, the first World Cup in an Arab and Muslim country. They need to go there and respect the culture. Muslim sportsmen coming to the West do not necessarily, they don't insist that the West stops invading foreign countries before playing sport or prohibit gambling and, you know, pornography and all this kind of stuff which is prevalent in the West, you know, because we realize that different countries have different cultures. And when you go to somebody else's country, you obey the law and you respect the country, you respect the local culture. And if you don't like it, you leave.
This is the first time that the World Cup has ever been hosted in the Middle East. Qatar's authorities have promised to provide a welcoming environment to all. This week, Doha's foreign minister responded angrily to what he called European arrogance and double standards. Many expect that activists on and off the pitch will stage protests throughout the competition. How Qatari authorities will police this remains to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The United States is not what you see in the flamboyant Hollywood movies. Normal life in the US might surprise you, as the number of people without a stable place to call home has increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800 since the pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites. Stay tuned, please. The Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They are frequently overlooked in the debate on how we solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions. Works Fund combines paid work in social enterprise with transitional housing and support services for people not currently eligible for housing first resources yet who are not self-resolving off the streets or out of shelters. Work programs act as a bridge for marginalized homeless populations with the capacity and desire to work to re-enter the workforce and obtain permanent housing. Tens of thousands of Americans fit that description. Solutions like work benefit not only their target population, but also the larger community through earnings, cost savings, increased labor hours, and more available housing. The three-pronged approach of the work model provides primary and secondary benefits, while its philosophy and implementation design allow for community integration and buy-in in a way that other strategies cannot. There has never been more urgency for employment-based solutions because of the ongoing labor shortage. The roughly 11 million jobs now unfilled represent a historic opportunity to increase employment among the homeless population. Employers are struggling to find workers, while over 70% of people experiencing homelessness are unemployed. And even those who are technically working are really underemployed. With more public support, work programs can develop relationships between local employers and municipal governments. Hill continued, homelessness is a symptom of many systematic failures of policy and practice in housing, behavioral health, workforce development, and the criminal justice system. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. It's past time to encourage innovation to develop programs that take into account the diversity of needs of people experiencing homelessness and promote the belief that those on the streets can and should be seen as assets to the community, as contributing members of society. Today, with homelessness on the rise in the U.S., U.S. citizens are perplexed by the lack of success their communities are having to adequately address this crisis. Also, Politico wrote, rising homelessness is tearing California cities apart. A crew of state workers arrived early one hot summer day to clear dozens of people camped under a dusty overpass near California's capital. The camp's residents gathered their tents, coolers, and furniture and shifted less than 100 feet across the street to city-owned land where they have been ever since. But maybe not for much longer. The city of Sacramento is taking a harder line on homeless encampments and is expected to start enforcing a new ban on public camping by the end of the month, if the courts allow. Also, Times of San Diego wrote, the first statewide snapshot of California's homelessness crisis since the pandemic hit, reveals that the number of people without a stable place to call home increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800. That's based on a Call Masters analysis of the federal government's point-in-time count, a biennial head count of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters tallied in by California cities and counties earlier this year for the first time since 2019. Homelessness experts mostly attribute the rise to precipitous drops in earnings during the pandemic among Californians already teetering on the edge. They also point to a worsening housing affordability crisis that is decades in the making. We have to solve this rotting core in the center of California, which is that we are a million units short of housing for exemplary low-income workers, said Margot Cochell, director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. While homelessness grew by 15%, roughly the same space as in recent years, something experts credit to pandemic-era safety nets like rental assistance, eviction moratoria, and stimulus checks. The data also indicates the problem has gotten worse for the state's Latino population. Critics are quick to point out the state is spending more than $14 billion on homelessness, but advocates say its response is just now beginning. The price tag is bigger now, said Tomika Moss, founder and chief executive of All Home, a San Francisco-based homeless policy organization, saying, "Meanwhile, the inflow is killing us." The numbers show the state's investment in shelters is bearing fruit. California created more than 14,000 shelter beds between 2019 and 2021. And local organizations reported this year the number of people staying in emergency and longer stay shelters ballooned by nearly the same amount, from 42,800 to 57,200 people, a 33% increase since 2019. Christopher Ware, president of the Center for Homeless Inquiry, said most people, most politicians, when they talk about homelessness, it's we're going to build X number of shelters. It's shelter, shelter, shelter. Well, all of this construction of shelters doesn't really change the scope of the problem. Meanwhile, the unsheltered count or the number of people staying in tents, tarps, cars, and other spaces unfit for human habitation grew by 7% between 2019 and 2022 to 116,600 people. That's a bomb, but perhaps not reflective of the growing palpability of the crisis that dominates local headlines, political debates, and neighborhood discussions.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. midterm elections are over, well, sort of, and the winner is
Well, if it was only that simple. As far as the House goes, looks like the Republicans have edged out the Democrats, but a red wave failed to materialize. Why did the Republicans fall short? Is that a prelude to a Trump loss if he runs for the ticket? And in terms of the Senate, it's off to a runoff that's due to be out in December. And if the Democrats retain that, does that mean a political deadlock when it comes to legislation, for example? Just some of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of the Spotlight. But first, these are our guests for this edition of the program. We have GOP strategist and political analyst Malik Abdul, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Daniel Shaw from the Answer Coalition, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Malik Abdul. Looking at the results, as I just mentioned, in terms of the House, it looks like the Republicans have it, unless you disagree with that. And the Senate, well, it's off to the runoff, as I mentioned, in December. What are your reactions, first of all, to how the results came out and what they show? What do you think is showing here?
If you look at and first of all, thanks for having me. If you look at the polls leading up to the race, it seems as if that the outcome so far pretty much aligns with the polls. The discussion of a red wave, the reason that we're having the discussion of a red wave mainly is because outlets, for instance, like the Cook Political Report, which is the research firm that releases a lot of polls, and at the time, the Cook Political Report, they were projecting that there were certain toss-up races. But I think it's important to understand that these are projections. And we saw a similar thing in 2016, where in that case, the polls then were all wrong in suggesting that Hillary Clinton was going to win, and ultimately Donald Trump came. In this place, the only thing that we're discussing is that Republicans didn't get the same number that was projected, as opposed to Republicans not being able to regain the House. As you said, yes, we're definitely going to regain the House. The question is what happens in the Senate, but I don't think anyone expected the Senate to hinge at this point what will seem to be on Georgia.
Sure. Well, the red wave comes about, and I'm going to throw this at you, if I may, Daniel Shaw, in terms of how 72% of voters, again, based on the polls, but one indicating that America is on the wrong track. 42% say they approve of the job that Joe Biden is doing, and 58% say they feel more worried that America's best years may have been already behind us, yet there was no red wave. So do you agree with that angle on that issue, on that topic?
Yeah, Joe Biden was celebrating to some extent the fact that there was no red wave. Nonetheless, the Democrats performed unimpressively in a country where the majority of us, some 37% of us, are saying that inflation in the economy is the main issue, along with gas prices. The Democrats have had no economic solution. The second most important issue, according to some polls, was abortion. Certainly, the Democrats did campaign around that issue. I think what's also very interesting is the absence of key points with these midterm elections. Practically nobody was talking about U.S. foreign policy. No one dared to bring up the $115 billion squandered on this proxy war against Russia, using the Ukrainian populace as a pawn to carry out this new Cold War, this ongoing geopolitical rivalry. And that's why roughly only one out of two Americans even participated in these midterm elections. And I think it's important to also highlight that I just came back from Brazil, where we knew on that Sunday night over 2 weeks ago that Lula had indeed won. Whereas here in the United States, quote unquote, the most advanced country in history, again, in quotation marks, the greatest democracy ever, as they constantly bombard it, we might not have the Senate race until after December 6th when the Georgia results come in. So I think it's telling, these contradictions.
Valid points. I think you made three of them, made my job really easier. I appreciate that. Thank you, because I'm going to ask those questions. Maybe not in that order. So first over to you. Take your pick, Malik Abdel. Some very important points made there. I think the part about the foreign policy is quite telling. As Daniel Shaw said, nothing was mentioned, really, when it comes to Ukraine, when it comes to Iran, for example, or a host of other foreign policy issues, which I don't think the U.S. Under Biden has scored any points on any of them.
Well, if you look at Joe Biden's foreign policy, a lot of people are questioning what happened. Joe Biden had, and he loved to tout, over 40 years of experience in Washington, D.C., and then his experience on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. But when it comes to our foreign affairs and our relationships around the world, I can't say that we're necessarily in a better position than we were under Donald Trump. In fact, I wouldn't say that we're in a better position. One of the first things that Joe Biden did is trip to Saudi Arabia. Instead of talking to the prime minister himself, the crown prince himself, he talked to his father. The relationship with OPEC Plus, what we're trying to do with the sanctions on Russia and many of those things, if you see across Europe, that these things have actually backfired. You see people protesting in the streets because of the economic anxiety, the energy crisis that's building. But meanwhile, here in America, we had the squad, or members of the progressive squad, write a letter to Joe Biden urging, in a sense, peace negotiations for the administration to urge peace negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. And then they had to pull back because they realized it wasn't popular with the elites in the party, despite the billions that we've sent over to Ukraine. Many people talk about the fact that instead of sending billions to Ukraine, maybe Joe Biden should have spent that money, diverted some of that money for student loan cancellation, but it didn't happen. And I absolutely agree with my co-panelists on the Brazil point. I'm on the show every day, Fault Lines, where we talk about this, and the race between Lula and Bolsonaro. Not only did they get the results on the same day, they have compulsory elections in Brazil. So you have to vote, and if you don't vote, you have to give a reason why you don't vote. But Brazil goes even further, and that they actually have transit is free. So they do a lot of things to actually ensure to help people get to the polls. Our system of elections here, it is absolutely unconscionable that 2 days after the election, and as my co-panelist said, and as far as the Senate, we won't know until after or December 6th, maybe at the earliest, whether or not that actually changes. I think it's absolutely shameful.
Daniel Shaw, is that system by design? Because it does sound so just out of date, this type of system, which I don't have the technicalities behind it. Playing the devil's advocate here, I mean, you could take a look at I don't want to say what Trump and his supporters may look at this as a way to say, well, look, the thing was rigged if it goes against them. But it seems outdated to wait so long for these results. Why do you think this is?
The system is replete with contradictions, as my colleague has pointed out. Not sure if Trump is in a position to point out those contradictions, considering that even though he won by lost by some 6.5 million votes in 2016, he still somehow became the president of this country. So this outdated electoral college system has really favored the Republicans so many times when they hadn't even won the popular vote. There's no other country in the world that has this type of antiquated electoral college system. So for the U.S. to tout itself as the most democratic country in the world, and to attack China, in Russia, in Iran, in the Bolivarian camp, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Bolivia, on these grounds really demonstrates the hypocrisy of this system. And to come back to the fact that so few Americans even felt invested in these elections. For many Americans, they say whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, it's the same system, a system that has failed to address millions of Americans without health care. School shootings on a daily basis, hundreds of school shootings in this calendar year, an opioid epidemic where over 100,000 Americans are dying every year. These are the hot issues. Of course, the economy is the number one issue, and it doesn't seem like either major party, both parties of war, parties of imperialism, parties of the elites in Washington, and this is what made Trump so popular. And this is why Trump is such a threat, I think the number one existential threat to the Democrats in 2024. Trump may have been an economic insider, but he was always a political outsider, and he was able to campaign on those grounds.
Okay, so those, again, thank you for making this easier for me, because I'm just throwing the question that you proposed to our guests in Washington, D.C. Some valid points there. You know, like Trump or hate Trump, he did do that. But, you know, these are core issues that are affecting the lives of many Americans. Obviously, and it's really telling how those issues didn't really even get highlighted, because you hear more about political wrangling and the Democrats versus the Republicans. There was not much focus, at least from the outside looking in. You're in Washington, D.C., perhaps you can tell us more whether you agree with that or not, Malik Abdel.
Yeah, and this is not just with this midterm election cycle. Typically, elections here in the U.S., they aren't focused on issues. They're maybe focused on or really honed in on a lot of wedge issues, and those are social issues. So things around abortion, for back in the day, it used to be gay marriage, but now it's trans rights, and all of these sort of things, you know, that typically are very divisive things. But the American people themselves, they don't get out in the street and protest this. I often talk about that the outside of maybe a race-related issue, something in response to police violence, or maybe abortion, Americans typically don't protest. Here in the United States, we still have black men who have been shot in the back of the heads by police officers, and there is no groundswell in the streets in opposition to that. Americans are, you know,
what do you think that is?
It's a very difficult thing to unpack. I think on the one end, with the race part, I think Donald Trump not being in office changed the game on a number of those things. I live here in Washington, D.C., and there was a lot of discussion in 2020 about Black Lives Matter. And Black Lives Matter Plaza, our actual mayor here, was one of the first ones to actually put a Black Lives Matter Plaza close to the White House here in Washington, D.C. There have been no protests since Donald Trump had been in office, and black men have continued to be shot by police. I think it mattered the political party that was in power. I think the Democratic Party, they don't want to challenge Joe Biden on many of the things that they would challenge a Republican administration on. And I'm not really just isolating this to Donald Trump. I think that there are certain allowances that are given to the Democratic Party that isn't the case when a Republican is in office. So you don't have people in the streets protesting these things. Brussels, Paris, all of the Prague, all around the country, people are protesting in the streets that they can't afford their energy bills. They're having to make certain decisions right about how they're going to put food on the table. That's not happening here in America.
Yeah, and France, I think, tops the list because they're just so protest-friendly. Okay, so you talked about Daniel Shah, the turnout not being as high as it should, and I'm wondering why. Well, I want to ask you why that is. I mean, one of the things that was somewhat important for it to have been highlighted was back in 2020 when the U.N. Special Rapporteur, talking about the U.S. and voting rights, actually said it's a tyranny, because he said electoral laws in parts of the U.S. And that person mentioned Texas, is undermining democracy by depriving millions of its citizens who belong to minority groups of the equal right to vote. Do you think, how much of a factor do you think that plays? And does that have anything to do with the midterms and the number of people who come out to vote, you think?
No question. Paul Robeson, Malcolm X, and many others said that the United Nations didn't need to investigate or invade any country in Southern Africa or the Caribbean. Right here behind me on 42nd Street, the United Nations should focus right here on the United States and all the violations of human rights and voting rights that exist right here in this country of some 340 million. But we'll never see that because we know the true function of the United Nations and these other playthings in the hands of U.S. foreign policy. This is a disaffected population. This is a population, the vast majority, who don't have true faith that these elections change anything. So that's why I think we saw a certain indifference reign very predictably once again during midterm elections. Biden was tooting his own horn, attempting to say that for the first time in some 40 years, the Democrats did not lose as many, the incumbent Democratic president and his party did not lose as many seats. And that's really the only thing that they had to celebrate. And I think it illustrates again why Donald Trump has such an appeal for so many. We know the U.S. has a war on Russia, and here comes Trump in typical loose cannon fashion saying, hey, I'll go to Moscow, I'll negotiate, I'll sit down with the Putin, I'll build my hotels over there. Imagine the true ruling class in Washington and on Wall Street and in the Pentagon when they hear Trump went to Pyongyang to meet with Kim Jong-un. These are things that are completely unacceptable to the true ruling class. That's why they've invaded Mar-a-Lago with the FBI. That's why Trump has been censored on Twitter. And this is not some ringing endorsement for me, for Trump. All the things about Trump as a racist, as a white supremacist, as a xenophobe, as a sexist are all 100% true, but he doesn't obey the true dictates of the true ruling class. And this is why they're so afraid of him in 2024.
One percentage that I read on this, which is very alarming, Malik Abdal, after that happened with the Mar-a-Lago raid, was that the notion of a civil war in the U.S. went up by 3,000+%, just the mere talk of it. Now, obviously, some people think that that's very far-fetched, but the mere fact that Americans are talking about it, and then so many polls come out that talk about the U.S. in those terms, is that a realistic thing to talk about in that way? Or are we looking at the polarity to be at such an extreme that that may seem to be a possibility? Polls are indicating, some are saying in the next few years, some are saying in the next decade.
I think that really matters according to which party is in power. Heading into the election, Joe Biden talked a lot about the existential threat Republicans were to the country. He talked a lot about domestic extremism. And in fact, just a couple of days before the election, Joe Biden was still out there pushing the same message and essentially saying that the threat to democracy was there if Republicans took back control. I think that's all rhetoric, but it's rhetoric that can be used to gin up excitement and anger and frustration in people to people all around the country. I don't think it's very realistic. There are certain things, you know, from my perspective, if you ask a question and people answer it, then that becomes the narrative. They don't have to answer, you know, ask these questions, but they choose to. And as far as Donald Trump is concerned, I know many people, I am a former Democrat. I was a Democrat. I voted for Barack Obama twice. I campaigned for him in 2008, but I was so disgusted with the idea of Hillary Clinton becoming president or the Democratic nominee in 2016 that I moved to the Republican Party. And since then, I've been advocating for conservative principles. Donald Trump was not my first and actually not my second choice, but I would not have voted for a racist or a white supremacist. But I understand that people have different interpretations, different feelings about Donald Trump. But I imagine that if Donald Trump chooses, and it seems as if next week, Donald Trump will absolutely announce his candidacy for 2024. And I imagine that if he announces his candidacy, that he will win the Republican primary against anyone. And if there is a Donald Trump and Tim Scott or a Donald Trump and Nikki Haley ticket, that will be anything that the Democrats have to offer.
But when I guess there are talks about how he was a Democrat and then he switched to the Republicans there, Daniel Shaw, I'm curious as to whether there are many Americans who want to withdraw from the party that they supported because, first of all, there were only two options, but yet there's not another party outside of those two that they can go to. There are, but they're not. They don't have any. They don't have any backing. I mean, I'm looking at something that really is shocking, at least based on the figure, Daniel Shaw, where for the federal and state spending for these midterm elections, do you know how much money was spent? Do you have any idea, Daniel Shaw?
Yeah, way too much.
$16.7 billion. That's CNBC. Now, another one, Open Secret, says $8.7 billion. These are figures that totally obviously show how money, which is not new news, but not to this amount, I don't think, because that's a record, how money has crept into U.S. politics to this degree. Now, I'm forging two questions in one. The fact that you have only two options, main parties, and the other, this spending that has come into U.S. politics. Daniel Shaw.
And that's why someone like myself has never been a Democrat, and I've never been a Republican, and I never will, because I understand the logic of the two-party system is to keep racism in the driver's seat in Washington, and imperialism, and U.S. foreign policy, this outdated unipolar model where the U.S. Foreign policy establishment doesn't want any challenge, diplomatically, economic, or militarily, from any quarters. I think in our heart of hearts across the United States, we feel, despite all this rhetoric about the greatest democracy in the world, there is no democracy. This is a plutocracy. This is a system based on how much money can you outspend your political opponents. And we saw this incredible propaganda blitz the last few weeks from both parties of capital in the elites. In the case of the Republicans, they had constant ads in Philadelphia and New York and across this country saying the Democrats are soft on crime and that the crisis of immigration is a Biden crisis and a Kamala Harris crisis. They never mentioned the crisis of U.S. imperialism and neoliberalism that continues to pillage these countries around the world. So it's nothing but rhetoric. The Democrats framed it as a crisis of democracy and that their base had to come out stronger than ever to defend democracy. But so many of us can see through the hypocrisy and ask, where is the democracy? As Malcolm X said, I see the hypocrisy, but no one can show me the democracy.
So come 2022, based on the results that we just have experienced, even though the Senate is still going to be out in December there, Malik Abdel, how do you think 2022 is going to look like, I'm sorry, 2024 is going to look like with elections coming? You said Donald Trump is going to come out. He's going to win that in terms of his party, the choice for the Republican Party. But overall, do you think that's going to serve the U.S.? Are we looking at a polarized U.S. going into the 2024, again, looking at the results from the midterms?
I think we are looking at a polarized U.S. from henceforth, moving on down the line. I don't see a point where we won't be, whether that the hope was or the assumption was, and at least that was the promise from Joe Biden, that he would take us back to this Camelot time that I don't actually remember in the U.S., this moment of Camelot where everyone got along and everyone's beautiful. Maybe that was the thing when Joe Biden got in office in the 70s. I'm really not sure. But that was the expectation, that Joe Biden will raise the level of discourse in America. And I can't say that that's something that he's done. So whether it's Donald Trump in 2024 or a Tim Scott, who would be my preference, or a Nikki Haley, or a DeSantis, or a Pompeo, or many of the other people who are being discussed as potential candidates for 2024, I don't think that's going to get better. On the Democratic side, you have Kamala Harris. There's some discussion in a lot of people, and to be clear, Kamala Harris hasn't helped herself in many ways, but there's a conversation that somehow people are going to move away from Kamala Harris, but I think she's going to be the nominee for Democrats in 2024.
Okay, thank you so much. That was Malik Abdel from Washington, D.C., GOP strategist and political analyst. Thank you. And Daniel Shaw from New York, thank you. Answer Coalition. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitapwe and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.